Hello and welcome to Managing MPN. I am Dr. Rajit Rampal, and today I will discuss emerging therapies in polycythemia vera. These are my disclosures. So let's start with a case study. Mr. V is a 68-year-old man who presents with plethora and mild splenomegaly. He was recently found to have a DVT in his left leg following a 7-hour-long car trip. Upon evaluation, he was found to have a hematocrit of 59.8%, a white count of 12.3, and platelets of 433. No other comorbidities in his history are noted. He has mild splenomegaly on exam, but otherwise the exam is unremarkable. So how do we approach the diagnosis of this patient? Well, talking simply, the myeloproliferative neoplasms are clonal hematopoietic stem cell disorders that include primary myelofibrosis, essential thrombocythemia, and polycythemia vera. The hallmark of MPNs is activation of the JAK-STAT pathway, and JAK2 mutations are found in 95 to 99% of PV patients and roughly half of ET and MF patients. Calreticulin mutations are found in about 30 to 40% of patients, and MPL mutations are found in about 10% of patients. Really rare mutations like LINK mutations are found in under 5% of ET and MF patients. And it's important to note there still remains about 10% or so of patients for whom a JAK-STAT driver mutation isn't identified in the setting of having diagnostic findings on a bone marrow examination for an MPN. Now, thinking about our patient who is clearly presenting with a polycythemia, how do we approach the management and diagnosis of this patient? It's important to always think about and exclude other causes of polycythemia, with the effort here being to distinguish between primary and secondary polycythemia. The JAK2 mutation in the context of having polycythemia, as well as other features, as we'll talk about in a minute, is usually conclusive to make the diagnosis of polycythemia vera. But in patients where one can't identify the mutation, a workup that includes assessing the patient's history very carefully, including looking for things like smoking, as well as medications like androgens, corticosteroids, or even recombinant erythropoietin is useful. Diuretic use as well can cause an elevation in the red cells. Other conditions as well, such as sleep apnea, COPD, or obesity, can also lead to an elevation in the hemoglobin and hematocrit. It's also important to always remember, of course, that things like renal cell carcinoma and hepatocellular carcinoma can present with polycythemia. Now, talking specifically about polycythemia vera, the WHO criteria changed as of 2016 for this diagnosis. The diagnosis is based on the finding of an elevated hemoglobin or hematocrit, as well as a bone marrow examination that shows a hypercellular bone marrow with panmyelosis, and finally the finding of a JAK2 mutation, whether this is the canonical V617F mutation in exon 14 or the exon 12 mutation. Minor criterion include a subnormal erythropoietin level. Now, it's important to note that the differences between the 2016 and the 2008 criteria include a lowering of the hematocrit threshold and hemoglobin threshold for diagnosis. And this was based on the observation that there are patients who didn't quite meet the threshold as was denoted in 2008, but were still having manifestations of disease and bone marrow findings consistent with polycythemia vera. As well, a bone marrow examination has now been added to the criteria for the diagnostic workup. This is not required in every single case. It depends on the hemoglobin and hematocrit levels. If it exceeds a certain threshold, then a bone marrow examination is not absolutely required by the WHO criteria. Now, why do the bone marrow at all if a patient has an elevated hemoglobin or hematocrit and has the JAK2 mutation? There's a couple of things to think about. One is that the bone marrow can help to identify the presence of fibrosis. And that is important prognostically because patients with fibrosis have a higher rate of overt fibrotic progression. And fibrosis is present in 14 to 48% of patients at a level of grade 1 or so at baseline. And so it's an important thing to consider as a prognostic marker. In general, having a bone marrow examination at baseline for MPN patients can provide a lot of useful information aside from just meeting WHO criteria. So what is the natural history of polycythemia vera? Well, we know that patients have an impaired overall survival versus the general population. There is a risk of leukemic transformation about 7% at 15 years. There's a risk of progression to myelofibrosis, another MPN, about 6% at 15 years. But there is most importantly a risk of thrombosis, which is 27% at 15 years. This is certainly not small and is really one of the main areas that we focus on in terms of our treatment of these patients. And so, in sum, the goals of therapy as such are to reduce the risk of thrombotic events and also to reduce the symptom burden in patients. Patients with polycythemia vera and MPNs in general can have a wide range of different symptoms, and these include night sweats, fevers, itching, myalgias, arthralgias, early satiety, abdominal discomfort, and most notably fatigue. And so it's important to keep the symptom burden in mind when you are managing a patient with polycythemia, not just focus on the hematocrit. How do we approach patients? We use therapeutic phlebotomies, we use cytoreductive therapy, in some cases we use JAK inhibitors as well. But it's also important to remember simple things like giving patients aspirin and lifestyle modifications. And this means emphasizing to your patients that control of their cholesterol, control of their weight, control of their blood glucose, control of their blood pressure are all fundamentally important considerations in managing their disease. Their approach to the management of patients with polycythemia vera is really based on the idea that there are differing risks of thrombotic events. We group people into the low-risk category if they're under the age of 60 and have never had a thrombotic event. And we group them into high-risk if they are over age 60 or have had a thrombotic event. These are relative terms because low-risk does not mean no risk. And in general, the risk of thrombotic events, even in low-risk patients, is greater than that in the general population. And so this is a relative tool, but it does change how we manage patients. In general, patients with low-risk disease are managed with phlebotomy, and those with high-risk disease are managed with cytoreductive agents. So coming back to the case of Mr. V, he undergoes a bone marrow examination and is found to have polycythemia vera by 2016 criteria. He does have a JAK2 mutation. He has no other comorbidities, and on exam he has mild splenomegaly. So what's the approach to the treatment of this patient? So remember that he is 68 and therefore falls into the high-risk category. Therefore, it is reasonable to put him on cytoreductive therapy as well as aspirin, 81 milligrams or low-dose aspirin, but full-dose aspirin is not required. So in terms of cytoreductive therapy, what is the right agent? The agents that have been traditionally used in the frontline setting include pegylated interferon as well as hydroxyurea. How do you choose what the right frontline treatment is for such a patient? Starting with aspirin, it's important to remember that randomized trials have demonstrated that there is a benefit to aspirin. And in this case, this study was utilizing 100 milligrams daily of aspirin, but 81 milligrams seems to have a similar effect. But compared to placebo, in terms of event-free survival, there was a clear statistical benefit for using aspirin. What about our goals for hematocrits, both from therapeutic phlebotomy or from cytoreductive therapy? This was examined in a phase 3 trial in which patients were randomized to two groups, one a low hematocrit group, less than 45 hematocrit, versus a high hematocrit group with a threshold of a hematocrit between 45 and 50. What was demonstrated in this study was that the patients kept in the lower hematocrit group had a lower incidence of cardiovascular events and lower incidence of mortality. And so therefore, the threshold of less than 45% has been established as standard of care, whether using a phlebotomy or using cytoreductive agents. Now, one question remains is this the appropriate hematocrit for female patients? The majority of patients in this particular study were male. And we do know that at baseline, males and females don't have the same baseline hematocrit. And there is evidence to suggest that a hematocrit of less than 42% may be more suitable for female patients. But nonetheless, 45% as the upper limit remains the standard. So what do we know about cytoreductive therapies? Well, hydroxyurea has been studied in a variety of settings, and sometimes it was in randomized trials versus historical agents such as piperbromine, which are no longer utilized, and so that data is really not quite so relevant anymore. But in a propensity matching analysis, when examining patients who received phlebotomy versus those who received hydroxyurea, there was a trend towards a lower number of cardiovascular events in the patients who received hydroxyurea versus those who had just received phlebotomy. What about interferon? Interferon has been widely used in patients with polycythemia vera, as well as essential thrombocythemia and myelofibrosis. And pegylated interferon has demonstrated the ability to control a patient's blood counts and drive down the JAK2 allele burden, which is an area that is being increasingly studied in terms of its implications. But how do you choose between the agents? Well, this has been the subject of a couple of different studies. The first was the Myeloproliferative Neoplasms Research Consortium 112 study, which was a randomized global phase 3 of frontline pegylated interferon alpha-2A versus hydroxyurea in patients with polycythemia vera or essential thrombocythemia. Patients were randomized 1:1 to hydrea versus pegylated interferon. An interim analysis was carried out at 12 months. So with regards to the data at 24 months, the overall response rate between hydroxyurea at 40.7% and pegylated interferon at 59.6% was essentially statistically the same. The CR rate, and this is displayed here in red, was 20.4% in the hydroxyurea arm and 28.8% in the pegylated interferon arm. So no statistical difference was found in terms of the overall response. Now, in terms of bone marrow response by histopathologic criteria, there was a slight increase actually in the hydroxyurea arm, 33% versus 16.9%, which was borderline significance. But it's important to remember that this was not all patients that were assessed from the study. In terms of side effects, notable side effects, of course, include fatigue, headaches, flu-like symptoms, abdominal pain, depression, and most of these were seen more frequently in the pegylated interferon arm. Hematologic side effects were notable for mild anemia as well as neutropenia, which in terms of the neutropenia was roughly equivalent between the two arms. Now, that data set would argue that really, at least at the time of 24 months, there doesn't appear to be an overtly significant difference between PV patients or ET patients treated with interferon versus those treated with hydrea. By contrast, a similar study was undertaken with a new drug called ROPEG interferon. This is a longer-lasting interferon that's administered every 2 weeks rather than every week, as is pegylated interferon. And this particular study randomized patients only with polycythemia vera to ROPEG interferon versus hydroxyurea. This was the PROUD-PV study, which was assessed after 12 months. And then there was a continuation portion of the study, which went up to 5 years. Now, this study initially had results that were similar to what I've described with the MPNRC-112 study, in which at about 12 months' time, it appeared that there was no real difference, although by the proportion of responders, there seemed to be some increase in patients responding in the hydroxyurea arm versus the interferon arm, which is in red. But interestingly, with more prolonged time, the curves invert. And in fact, the response rate does increase over time in the ROPEG interferon-treated arm as we go into month 36, with 70.5% of patients deemed to be responders in the ROPEG arm, whereas 51%, 0.4% of the hydroxyurea-treated patients were responders at month 36, which met statistical significance. In terms of adverse events, there were hematologic side effects, including thrombocytopenia, leukopenia, and anemia noted in both treatment arms. An increase in the LFTs was noted in the ROPEG interferon-treated patients as well as some myalgias. But in general, it appeared that the treatment was well tolerated. So based on this, the ROPEG interferon has actually been approved in the European Union for frontline treatment of patients with polycythemia vera who are high risk. This is still undergoing regulatory review in the United States and may possibly be an option for our patients in the United States in the relatively near future. But nonetheless, this data does at least give us some evidence on which to base an initial treatment decision of hydroxyurea versus, in this case, ROPEG interferon. So in our patient's case, our patient is initially started on hydroxyurea at 1,000 milligrams daily, which is a reasonable and appropriate thing given the data that I've shown you. But the patient is still requiring phlebotomy every 3 months, which is still a substantial phlebotomy burden. The dose of hydroxyurea is increased to 2,000 milligrams daily, but the patient now encounters hematologic side effects, namely leukopenia at the dose of hydroxyurea that's required to control the hematocrit. So what do we do for this patient now? What are our treatment options? Well, it's important to realize that there are established definitions for hydroxyurea resistance and intolerance, and these are ELN criteria. Patients are deemed to be intolerant if they have side effects such as GI toxicity, fevers, mucocutaneous ulcers, or skin ulcers at any dose. Intolerance is also deemed to be cytopenias at doses that are required to achieve hematocrit control. And so incurring neutropenia or anemia or even thrombocytopenia at a dose of hydroxyurea that you need to control the hematocrit would meet that definition. As well, resistance is defined as the still needing phlebotomy when on a dose of 2 grams or greater per day of hydroxyurea, platelets over 400,000 at that dose, no reduction in massive splenomegaly at that dose, and no reduction in spleen symptoms at that dose of 2 grams per day. Based on these criteria, a trial called the RESPONSE trial was carried out. And this was a trial for patients who met the definition of hydroxyurea resistance or intolerance, who were randomized to receive the JAK1/2 inhibitor ruxolitinib at a dose of 10 milligrams twice daily, or standard therapy as selected by the investigator. In most cases, this did turn out to be hydroxyurea. So patients were randomized and were assessed at week 32. The endpoint of the study was hematocrit control and spleen size reduction. So if we look at the composite primary endpoint, this was achieved by 20.9% of patients in the ruxolitinib arm, but only 0.9% of patients in the standard therapy arm. Breaking this down by the components of the endpoint, 38% or so of patients achieved a spleen volume reduction of 35% versus 0.9 in the control arm or standard therapy arm. But importantly, hematocrit control was achieved in 60% of patients who got ruxolitinib versus only 19.6% of patients who got standard therapy. In terms of the symptom profile, there was a decrease in the total symptom score burden that patients who were treated with ruxolitinib faced. And so as you can see here, symptom clusters such as cytokine symptom clusters or hyperviscosity or splenomegaly related symptoms all improved on patients treated with ruxolitinib at a higher degree than that was seen with the standard therapy arm. But more importantly, if we break this down by the individual components, so things like headaches or sweating or night sweats, all decreased substantially in patients treated with ruxolitinib, whereas in some cases on standard therapy, these symptoms did in fact increase. Now, what about the durability of response? As it turns out, the response to ruxolitinib in these patients seems to be rather durable. The most recent updated data has shown that the majority of patients, now several years out from this randomization, appear to still continue to tolerate and benefit from ruxolitinib therapy. So this has been approved by the FDA for patients who are resistant or intolerant to hydroxyurea and represents a standard of care option for our polycythemia vera patients. Notably, the JAK2 allele burden does appear to decrease in the majority of patients treated with ruxolitinib. A large proportion of patients did actually achieve a 50% reduction in their JAK2 allele burden, which meets definition for a partial molecular response. And in fact, several patients did approach almost 100% reduction in the JAK2 allele burden, but these were the minority of patients. Now, beyond ruxolitinib in the second line, one can also switch to interferon if one has started with hydroxyurea and vice versa. If one starts treating a patient with interferons, one could always switch to hydroxyurea. So the options are really two drugs, more or less, that are available and then can be used in patients who fail their initial cytoreductive therapy for polycythemia vera. But what else is out on the horizon? Well, one class of drugs that is being intensely studied in patients with MPNs in general, and in particular patients with polycythemia vera, are MDM2 inhibitors. So MDM2 is a ubiquitin ligase that binds to and leads to the degradation of p53. And in fact, if in analysis of primary patient samples, levels of MDM2 seem to be higher in patients with MPNs and PV in particular versus normal controls. The therapeutic approach or thought here is that if one inhibits MDM2, the activity of p53 may be restored, therefore leading to apoptosis of the MPN cells. And in fact, this has been studied and demonstrated in preclinical settings. And so this has led to the idea that this could be utilized as a clinically active therapeutic strategy. So this was studied in the MPN-RC, the Myeloproliferative Neoplasms Research Consortium 115 study, in which patients received an MDM2 inhibitor or an MDM2 inhibitor plus interferon. And if we just look at part A, in which patients received the MDM2 inhibitor, the overall response rate, which was both CR and PR, was about 58%. It is a relatively small number of patients who were evaluated in the study, but nonetheless, this is at least proof of a clinical activity of this inhibitor and of this therapeutic concept in general. The JAK2 allele burden in patients who were treated with the MDM2 inhibitors actually did increase over the time of treatment, and in only one or two cases did the allele burden actually go up. But in most cases, there was a reduction, and in some cases, a pretty marked reduction in the JAK2 allele burden. As well, the symptom scores did decrease in the majority of patients who were treated on study. In terms of side effects, a vast majority of patients, 83% of patients, experienced GI toxicity, mainly diarrhea that was grade 1 or 2, with about 16 to 17% obtaining grade 3 level of diarrhea. Fatigue was a notable side effect in 66% of patients at grade 1 or 2, and at 33% of patients at a level of grade 3. Other notable side effects included nausea as well in this particular study. Now, other approaches for us to think about have little, I guess, shift gears and talk a little bit more about changing how we fundamentally approach our PV patients. So as I have talked about at the beginning of our discussion today, we stratify patients into the low risk and to the high risk groups. And our approach has been traditionally to give cytoreductive therapy to only the high-risk patients and really focus on phlebotomy and aspirin for low-risk patients. But the question remains, is this the right approach? Could low-risk patients with PV still benefit from having cytoreductive therapy? This question has begun to be addressed in a study that was presented at the European Hematology Association as a plenary talk in 2020. And the study was a phase two randomized study that compared ROPEG interferon. So again, this is the long-acting interferon given every 2 weeks versus phlebotomy in low-risk PV patients. The study looked at hematocrit control as well as disease progression. And in fact, if we look at the composite endpoint, a higher number of patients, 84% of patients, achieved the endpoint who were of those treated with ROPEG interferon versus 60% in standard therapy. In terms of hematocrit control, the proportions were roughly the same, 80% achieved control versus 66% in the standard arm. But interestingly, 8% of patients in the standard arm had disease progression, which was not observed in patients treated with ROPEG interferon. And so this data is intriguing and raises the question, should we intervene earlier with therapeutics such as interferon, which we think may have some disease-modifying ability? This is an important question, and in fact, the Data Safety Monitoring Board of the study stopped the study based on these results. There is further follow-up coming, but the study was halted because of these results. It does now raise the question, should we intervene earlier? We will need to see more data in larger numbers of patients, but it is quite possible that the entire paradigm that we've talked about today in terms of approaching the treatment of these patients may change in the very near future. Finally, and the last point I will touch upon in today's presentation is that we've talked extensively and almost exclusively today about thrombotic risk. And again, the reason for that is the greatest risk facing our PV patients is thrombotic events as well as bleeding events. But it's important to remember that progression to myelofibrosis or to acute leukemia remain significant risk for our patients. And I think that this risk may increase with time. This risk assessment is important in somebody who is relatively younger. In somebody who may be diagnosed at the age of 80, the relevance may not be so great. But if somebody is diagnosed at the age of 50, who would otherwise have decades of life ahead, that risk of transformation to a more severe phase of the disease remains a very significant consideration. Now, we don't really have great prognostic tools in general to figure out who the progressors are going to be. This remains an open and important question in the MPN field. How can we predict which of our patients are going to have progressive disease? One tool that has been recently put forward is to use genomic data. So in general, in patients with myelofibrosis, we've become quite good at using clinical factors as well as genomic factors to try to predict which patients would have the highest risk of progression. We are only beginning to do this now in patients with polycythemia vera and essential thrombocythemia. One risk scoring tool that has been published and put forth by the Mayo Clinic group is the mutation enhanced prognostic scoring system for polycythemia vera, in which a number of variables emerged as potentially heralding disease progression. And these include the presence of an SRSF2 mutation, which is a splicing factor mutation and has been implicated in the leukemic transformation of myelofibrosis patients, an abnormal karyotype, an age at diagnosis over the age of 67, and a leukocyte count over 15,000. Now, these data remain to be validated in other studies, but at least this gives us the beginnings of a tool and a perspective to think about how we might prognosticate who our patients at highest risk of disease transformation are. So to summarize, the goals of therapy in polycythemia vera are aimed at symptom alleviation and the reduction of the thrombotic risk. Prognostication of thrombosis as well as disease progression remain major challenges. We have no perfect tool to tell us who's going to have a clot and who's going to progress, but these are active areas of investigation. Cytoreductive therapies are usually reserved for patients who are refractory to or intolerant to phlebotomy, as well as those who fall into the high risk thrombotic category. But as we've talked about, that might change in the near future. The order of therapies in first line, Hydrea versus interferon, is under investigation, and notably, ropeg interferon was approved in the first line in the European Union based on phase 3 data. Ruxolitinib, a JAK1/2 inhibitor, is approved in the United States for patients who fit the criteria of being intolerant or resistant to hydroxyurea. As well, several other pathways in it are being investigated for patients who fail our current conventional therapies, and we've talked about MDM2 inhibitors as an example of that. Finally, new data regarding the timing of cytoreductive therapy suggests a possible benefit for earlier intervention in our patients. With that, I'd like to conclude and thank you for your attention.